Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Brexit means Brexit.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
Hello and welcome to Mid-Atlantic, the show where we look at the news and the views from one side of the Atlantic from the perspective of the other. I'm Royfield Brown, who's in the Bay Area, but not for much longer because I've decided to go home as borders come crashing down. Today, I'm joined by Emma Burnell in London.
Hiya.
Friend of the show. Benjamin Jacobs, who's in Cranston, Rhode Island.
Greetings.
And my podcast wife from another podcast, Claire Asprey.
Hello.
Who's in Luton.
I'm not in Luton. I'm in Bedford, but carry on.
Thank you for the clarification. I know, but it's all the same over there.
And you live in Wolverhampton.
That's me. In a week that has seen the world declare war on the coronavirus, we've decided to check in on each other. Very obviously, the world is in the grip of the most serious crisis since World War II. And what I thought we'd do, instead of just really rattling and prattling through and, dare I say, regurgitating and putting our spin on what other bits of news we might have actually gleaned in the last 2 or 3 days, I thought we'd have very much a human conversation between myself and my friends, people who I respect, but also they're in the grip of this crisis as well, but also with a couple of people who will have an idea of local government's response to specific bits of the pandemic. So that's the reason why we're joined by Ben, Beardy Ben, and by the wonderful Claire, joining Emma and I on this week's Mid-Atlantic.
I mean, let's go over some of the details of this. The president says the solution to the economic pain from the coronavirus outbreak is a massive rescue package. He's asking Congress for a huge bailout, and it is one that, as you mentioned, would include cash payments from the government that would be sent to most Americans within 2 weeks.
It's going to be bold, and the level, again, of enthusiasm to get something done, I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like it.
This morning, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin will be meeting with Republican senators about the president's plan. He will ask for a total of $850 billion to deal with the economic fallout from the coronavirus. $50 billion of that would go to help bail out the airline industry. The president also wants to see the government send cash payments to Americans immediately to cushion the economic blow from the outbreak. No word on exactly what the amount of those checks might be, and the payments would not be sent to millionaires. Also, the package would include allowing people and businesses to delay tax payments without interest or penalties for 90 days beyond April 15th.
We must act like any wartime government and do whatever it takes to support our economy. And that's the main purpose of this press conference this afternoon. We must support millions of businesses and tens of millions of families and individuals through the coming months. And to do that, the government machine must and will respond with a profound sense of urgency. Thousands of brilliant officials are already working round the clock, but we must do more and faster. This is a disease that is so dangerous and so infectious that without drastic measures to check its progress, it would overwhelm any health system in the world. And I've used the Italian health system. It is excellent. And the problem is not with the health systems, it's the numbers of sufferers. That's why we announced the steps yesterday that we did, advising against all unnecessary contact, steps that are unprecedented since World War II. Ultimately, to beat this crisis, we will need a combination of better science, technology, medicine, data, government, operations, economic support, learning from other countries, and social support. As time goes on, we will learn more and more about the disease and the effects of our actions. And while we need national unity, we also need international cooperation. And although we now need to impose physical distance between ourselves, we must at the same time have closer social support for each other.
First off, things have moved so fast that come Sunday, I had no plans to fly back home to the UK, but I have two parents. My father is 75, my mother is 72. And if this pandemic is going to go on as long as August, September, who knows? I can't be away from my parents for that amount of time, not knowing what shape they're in or what help they'll actually need. So I've decided to fly back on Thursday. First off, let's go with you, Ben, because I know that you have a relatively young child in your care. How is the emerging crisis affecting you personally?
My family has we've got a bunch of health problems. My wife has reduced lung capacity and a variety of chronic health conditions. My daughter is nonverbal. What Rhode Island did is they do want to set up e-learning, but they have not done any planning for it previously, which is something of a theme. And so what they did is they took the April break, moved it up. So this week school's closed. And so all the childcare options are off the table. Meanwhile, you know, in my household, we've sort of had cold symptoms, flu-like symptoms for weeks now. You know, just this past week, my daughter spiked a temperature and then my wife did. So we're sort of like, well, I can't go to work, but we don't know necessarily what's going on. So we've been scrambling to try and get my wife tested while trying to manage a nonverbal four-year-old at home who's slowly going. She's already recovered from whatever it was, of course, but you know, slowly going stir crazy, as are we all, I suppose. And yeah, so the big thing is just trying to get tested. Even
before we come on to testing and maybe the lack of testing that there's been in the United States, personally, how has the state been with you working from home? Is it just a case of just work from home? Is there any particular mandates for you to be able to effectively still do your job but officially still be working from home?
That's not quite right. So the governor has issued an executive order saying that anyone who can work from home probably should be, you know, encouraging bosses to be flexible about that kind of thing. The director of my division is, you know, somewhat new. She's really been trying to shake things up and be a force for positive change. And so like 8 months ago, she put in to try and get the e-work, you know, teleworking thing going and set things up for people like me who need very expensive GIS softwares to do our job and, you know, access to my data at work. And it's sort of been, let's say it's been a slow process that hasn't come to fruition yet. And so all of a sudden now there's this emergency and the, you know, IT department is scrambling to try and get everybody set up for doing teleworking. And so it's been a real struggle. Basically, we're all putting in for telework one way or the other. Mm-hmm. But for me and a couple of my colleagues who do similar kinds of work that require very specialized programs, it's sort of either we're healthy enough to go into the office, or in my case, I'm staying home. Tomorrow I'm going to start teleworking, but basically I'm just going to be doing work for other people that isn't my usual job, just so mm-hmm. I have something to do and I'm not burning a year's worth of sick time.
So it's still, so even though the governor has basically said that people should be working from home, this is still counted as sick time, you working from home at the moment?
For right now, I haven't been doing any work because I haven't been able to.
Okay.
So, you know, starting tomorrow, we're going to finagle it basically so that I can be technically doing teleworking. Mm-hmm. But gotcha. It's not my usual work. And until, you know, IT gets around to setting up some sort of system for me to get to my desktop remotely, mm-hmm. I'm either burning sick time or I'm doing someone else's work for them.
The UK's response to the corona emergency has been somewhat different from continental Europe. First off, why is that? And can you kind of sum it up for us as to where the UK government actually is now in terms of self-isolation and mass gatherings?
Well, I think we've actually caught up with the rest of Europe now, but they were doing it quite slowly, deliberately. And their gamble is that by doing it that way, there would be a shorter period of time that people need to do it. And their thinking was that people are going to get bored and will start breaking the rules. So the shorter, the more contained you can make it, the yeah. better. But things have moved very, very, very quickly. And we're now pretty much in lockstep with not places like Spain, where they've basically just told everyone to stay in their homes, but everyone is being told to socially distance. Lots of things have been shut down. Because I go to the theatre a lot, as you and your listeners will know, because I'm constantly banging on about it with our takeaway of the week. Mm-hmm. That most of the theatres, I've just had email after email after email today saying this, we've closed and this is cancelled. My ballroom dancing classes were cancelled, which is very sad. I just mastered the rumba. and people over 70 and people with underlying health conditions are being told to self-isolate for 12 weeks. That doesn't mean simply stay in your home. You can walk the dog, but you shouldn't go to the supermarket, for example. It's just really scary. They've also announced just now a huge packet of economic measures to try and help people get through, which I haven't seen the detail yet. I don't think anyone has, but there's things like a mortgage holiday for people who get coronavirus, business rate relief, which will help some small businesses, although it won't compensate for the lack of earnings, and that's where the real worry is. By the way, that's hay fever, not anything more serious. But you always have to say that now, don't you? It's so odd. Mm-hmm. So I just think my parents are self-isolating. I got a call from my dad on Sunday, and my dad is just, he loves his family like so, so much, and he always wants us to be around. And when he lived an hour away from London, I used to stay over the night there, and I've never stayed overnight in their new house, but he always, always wants me to. And I'm like, Dad, the whole reason you moved here is so I could drive home. but he called me to say, don't come over. And that must have been the hardest thing in his life, to call his children. My brother is supposed to be coming from Australia in May. That's very unlikely to happen. And if he does, my parents won't be able to see them. And it's his 40th birthday. That's what he was coming for. So I think, the personal impacts are already taking a big toll. I'm in many ways, I'm really, really pleased that my dad is going against his nature. He is behaving exactly as he should be behaving. They're doing everything right. But it's going to be a very, very long year.
It's been stunning for me seeing how the San Francisco Bay Area has closed down, progressively closed down in the last week. Early last week, I could drive down the 880, one of the main kind of freeways that straddles the East Bay, then go across the bay. And you know, at whatever time of day, there's, you know, what the level of traffic there is actually going to be on that road. Tuesday of last week, there's noticeably less. I flew straight into San Francisco.
Wow.
And I was just traveling around. And I would say by then it was maybe 25% less traffic on the road. By Sunday, you felt like it was Christmas Day. And being in the centre of San Francisco was utterly an eerie experience, considering it was, you know, even though it was a Sunday, we're talking about a city which is very much a tourist hub and is a conference hub. And just taking away those people, let alone local people, then deciding not to go out, it felt like you were driving around on Christmas Day. Christmas Day, the Christmas Day of Christmas days. You know, there was literally nobody out on the streets. And the one thing it did really amplify for me was, not that it needs remarking upon, but I will say, is the level of the homeless problem and the people who are in housing despair and distress here, because those are the only people out in the centre, actually. Of the city, it was absolutely marked. And then on a personal kind of point of view, all of my friends over here are working from home. The schools have closed. I think the schools closed last week, end of last week. Kids were just not going to school anyway, and then increasingly teachers just weren't turning up. So we've had the governor here basically say, that's enough of that. You know, there are no mass gatherings. And as of yesterday, the governor, and I think there's been coordination between the various local bodies. So the city of San Francisco with the city of Oakland, et cetera, basically said no pubs, no bars, no anything. And I got a tweet from the SFPD basically saying, we are going round to bars to enforce the fact that they will not be open. You know, it doesn't quite feel like Italy levels of lockdown, but this is utterly unprecedented. And a lot of it has been, as I said, kind of self-enforcing first, and then the local governance, whether it's on a city level or county level or state level, has then kind of caught up throughout the week and decided to enforce this lockdown. Claire, obviously you have a daughter. Just give us an idea of how your work week is going to be kind of structured, considering you're a single mother.
So I just had a notification today from my daughter's school that they're sending home for 3 days, 2 year groups in the school. Mm-hmm. My daughter's gutted that it's not her year group. That's basically because, as even before official school closures, which are not happening, we are getting to a position where, as staff are having to self-isolate, the ability of a school to carry on in their normal way is reducing. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a sort of proactive attempt to manage that by sending home children who are broadly old enough to stay at home without adult supervision, but not the year that taken their exams. So that's literally today. I mean, we've had different announcements every day this week from school. At a personal level, my grandma is in a care home, and we had a notification just before the weekend that every resident was only allowed to have two nominated visitors. So I didn't get to see her this weekend because I wasn't on the list of two nominated visitors. And as of today, we've had the notification that there will be no external visitors to the home. So I don't know when I might see her next, actually, or if, because she's very frail and she's 96. So I don't know how that's going to pan out. And, you know, but my parents' generation are all over 70. So they're, you know, I spent an interesting hour on the phone yesterday trying to get my dad loaded up on WhatsApp and from a distance and it not working. There are, you know, some kind of technological things that we can overcome, but we need to sort out. I spent some time getting my mum and my stepdad all both on a kind of NHS app on their phones. And so there's a lot of just putting stuff in place, really. And in terms of work, I have a fairly small team and we're all geared up to work from home. So we are lucky in the sense that we are able to do that, but we may have to redeploy to other sorts of work because anything that's less than essential or critical would, you know, fall away for the things that are clearly more frontline services. So we'll wait and see. But at the moment, what we're doing is just shifting how we do meetings. We're doing more virtual meetings. We've got the capacity to work from home and particularly where staff have underlying health conditions. You know, it's easier for them to not have to travel on public transport or come into a big busy office. So we're accommodating that if possible.
Ben, quick question to you, because it can seem somewhat complicated or confusing to at least us Brits looking at American governance at the best of times. But could you just give us some kind of sense? It doesn't have to be definitive because I'm just throwing this at you, but just give us some kind of sense as to what regulations are truly federal. What is the purview of the federal government to do with this? And then what is the purview of state or local governments? If we do deal with the United Kingdom, just as an example, fundamentally, Boris Johnson's writ runs throughout the whole country and stuff. But I'm very struck that here it's a case of Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, has been saying and doing things and closing down schools, etc., way before the federal government, the Trump administration, took things particularly seriously. So just give us just a rough sense as how things break down, please.
Sure. So from a constitutional level, there are two people in the United States, if you will. There is the federal government and there are the states. Mm-hmm. Local governments don't exist except at the pleasure of the states. So that's the first thing to notice. Although in practice, that's not necessarily what happens. But so you have the federal government, you have the states. The federal government has control over interstate commerce and things that are related to that. And they have the power to coordinate the states and they have the power to manage programs that are countrywide. But the way that works, people don't, even the US often don't realize this, is that essentially the federal government can set regulations and then provide resources, but the actual on the ground work is done by the states in order to basically work within the boundaries of the Constitution. So, for example, the federal highway bill that was passed in the 50s and basically governs how roads are done in this country to this day. The way that works is that there is a federal Department of Transportation. There is a federal highway administration. They set policy, they have regulations, but what they actually do is that they then take big bags of money and hand it to the state departments of transportation. Mm-hmm. So that's just an example. So in terms of a disease outbreak like this, you have the federal government, which has some powers to to control things, but really only in the case of absolute emergencies. The big federal character is the CDC. And there's some other agencies that are supposed to cooperate with the CDC. The CDC is, they're supposed to have the capacity to generate resources, physical, financial, whatever. Most of the financial resources end up going through FEMA in emergencies, the Federal Emergency Management Administration. But really what the CDC is expected to do is to have done research and be able to provide guidance. A lot of that capacity certainly exists. And then they're also supposed to help coordinate the science end of things as it develops, sort of in real time.
Okay.
In terms of everything else, that's the states. In as much cooperation with local governments as they choose to permit the local governments.
Okay. And then I suppose a similar question to you, Claire. If there is a particular outbreak within the city of which health services have to react to, is that purely something which the city of Nor, the county, etc., then needs to find budget for? Or would there be some kind of national body, some UK organisation that will kind of swoop in and provide you with the funds? Just give us a rough kind of sense of how things kind of break down on a UK level, please.
Well, I think some of it is quite unclear at the moment, and obviously there are going to be increased costs, and I think that, you know, it would be nice to see central government be more proactive about some of that. At a local level, there's a lot of activity which is happening, and my understanding at this point in time is that there would be a requirement to cover it in a local budget, but with the hope that there will be some kind of support coming back from central government later on. But I don't know where that's going to go. So again, it's a very, very rapidly changing picture. But the need to mobilise is going to take precedence at this point. And obviously, the way that health is funded in the UK is, it's quite a complicated picture, because we have a number of different types of health trust and body. So without getting into too much detail, obviously it's a national health service, yeah, but we have a lot of local health provision. So we have a clinical commissioning group at a local level, but we also have the trusts that run the hospitals or the mental health trusts. There are different forms of organization that manage different parts of the system. It isn't a single sort of monolithic system, that the NHS. It is quite a diverse picture of providers and commissioning. And, you know, obviously the money is effectively central government generated, but each organisation will have a sort of responsibility for its own part of that. And then they would work and collaborate at a local level, and then also at a regional level where that's, you know, required. So it's, it very much, the focus is on, partnership and making stuff happen mm-hmm. at this point.
Yeah, that's pretty similar. It's not how it's supposed to work in the US, but that's similar.
Mm. Emma, obviously the world is going to, has gone headlong into what's going to be a major recession. Which industries do you think are particularly on the front line? Obviously, it's going to affect every industry eventually, but which are the industries which are going to feel the effects of COVID-19 first, do you think?
Well, I think we already know which industries have felt the effects, and it's largely those who have part of their supply line based in China. Mm-hmm. That has been a real issue for a lot of auto manufacturers, in particular, but also other people. But I'm not sure that there's going to be an industry that will not be affected. This isn't the kind of crisis where there'll be winners and losers, or at least it doesn't feel that way. Because the thing with governmental response is that usually what they do is bring in measures to convince consumers to go and spend more. Mm-hmm. That is the way that a government will basically get itself out of a recession. But they can't do that because they don't want us going out and spending more. They don't want us buying things online and sending lots and lots of Amazon delivery drivers to everybody's house. So their tools are a bit blunted because they can't really do the demand side, which is where a lot of the problems are.
I just add to that that in Rhode Island, but in a lot of places, the service industry and the tourism industry are extremely important, and they're like, it's almost like no one's complaining at this point to a certain extent. That's not entirely true. There's definitely people who are complaining, but you know, it's almost like they are, I get a like, you know, the UK going into World War II kind of feeling, like this is going to destroy us, but it's what we have to do kind of thing. You know, these are small businesses operating on thin margins without corporate backing. They have mortgages, they have employees, and they're just shutting up their doors and, you know, locking the doors and walking home.
Congress and the White House has approved an $850 billion stimulus package, but today. But you are correct, Emma, that it's kind of hard to understand, other than giving people, let's say, people who can't afford to pay their mortgages and their rent, etc., things like that. It's hard to see actually where that money can go into the economy immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. Our economy, particularly in the UK and the West in general, it's largely run on services. We've outsourced a lot of our manufacturing. And we are run on retail as well. You know, we buy a lot of crap. And that's how we send money flowing around. I think one of the things that will come out of this, and I'm actually writing this piece at the moment for Prospects, is a newer sense of why we need a state, whether that state be at state level, local level, or national level, or supranational level. It's actually, just as there are no atheists in a foxhole, there are actually no libertarians in a coronavirus crisis.
But, you know, whilst my gut is completely and utterly to agree with you, let's say if I am a lizard brain, totally right-wing thinking libertarian, I could turn round and say self-isolation, it's every man for himself, that's libertarian. I could say, look at Europe, you know, in this dream of pan-European brotherhood. Germans have now erected borders, everyone's putting them up. You, right here and now, you could say that you've been vindicated.
No, I wouldn't agree with that, because self-isolation isn't about protecting yourself. It's about community. It's about herd contagion. So self-isolation is actually not a selfish thing to do. It's an unselfish thing to do. It's important that we all do it, but we're not, for most of us, if and when, and it's more when than if, as I understand it, we get the coronavirus, it will feel like a mild flu. But it's unlikely to feel like a mild flu for my dad. So I have to self-isolate to protect other people. So I honestly don't think that's the case. And also, the US government is spending, $600 and something billion. The UK government have just announced £300+ billion. That is the kind of input into the economy that 2 weeks ago, maybe even 2 days ago, Tories would have been screaming about.
Is that what we're going to see as an upside to this? Is that in America, and I'll just go with you, Ben, and then on to you, Claire. Let's say in America that the state will be vindicated, that and also scientific thought is going to be vindicated, because there's been an erosion of the respect that we pay towards people who have actually sat down and studied things. You know, we live in a world of instant reactions, of people saying, well, to hell with the facts, this is what I feel, and whatever. And maybe if there's going to be any good that comes out of this is that people who have degrees, doctorates, etc., we're actually going to take those people a little bit more seriously, aren't we? What do you reckon, Ben?
It's hard to say. It certainly feels that way right now, but you know, the flat Earth people are still out there. they're, you know, they may be just sticking to their own circles, but there's certainly, if you look online, there's plenty of people who are denying that this is even a thing, that are, you know,
but surely that's been overtaken by the fact that, you know, the denier in chief, Trump, has turned around yesterday and his tone changed.
Yeah. I would say that they're on the back foot. but they have, you know, several decades of momentum, political momentum behind them. It's, you know, and it's down to how things get managed over the next couple of months, how bad things get, and how the narrative gets shaped in terms of why things happened this way, that I think is going to shape how things go forward in terms of this stuff. You know, if we all can just sort of say, you know, hollowing out the CDC, for example, was a bad idea. Having an entirely nationalistic approach to trying to develop testing kits was a bad idea.
Ben, that's not something that the Trump administration did. That was Obama's fault. Trump explained that last week, didn't he? So it's all Obama's fault, even though he did it. You know?
Yes. I mean, that's the thing. If he's able to shape that narrative with a substantial portion of the population, then, you know, this is going to end and we're going to go back to hollowing out the state and, you know, this will happen again. I think that it's fair to say that there's for most of the people in the United States, there's an extremely limited appetite for that kind of spin right now. Mm-hmm. But I have my own echo chamber, so I don't know if I can speak for, you know, the most of the population, to be sure.
Okay, just to wind this down, because I'm acutely aware that, as we said at the start of the show, we can't really just go through all the news that's happened in the last 24 hours, because by the time I edit and put this out, half of it will be redundant. But looking forward, everybody, I'm going to go through everybody. Just give us a sense of how this is going to impact your future plans or the things you are looking forward to, and how the fact that the coronavirus has come, how this is going to, dare I say it, change those plans. And I must admit, I'll go first. As somebody who is crazy about the sport of football, real football, and the fact that I'm a Birmingham City supporter, and we've had a fair to middling season in the second tier of English football. And as ridiculous as this sounds, I can't help but feel sad for those Liverpool supporters who haven't won the championship for 30 years and are running away with the Premier League, and the league might get cancelled. And it's ridiculous in the greater scheme of things. But as somebody to be even worried or concerned about this, but I do love sport. I do love football. I quite like Liverpool. And it's something which, in the greater scheme of things, doesn't really matter. But if I was a Liverpool fan, I'd be like, bloody hell, you know, the cosmic forces of injustice have managed to come and even rip this away from us after we waited 30 years to win a football championship. As I said also towards the start of the show, I've decided to come home, cut short my American trip. And we had a live show for Dum Dee Dum, one of the podcasts which I do, scheduled for May the 19th in London. And I was planning on coming back just before then to go and do that. Though it hasn't officially been cancelled, I think we can safely say that that's not going to happen. I haven't heard from the venue, but, you know, it's almost definitely not going to happen. And so that's just like a couple of ways of which this, on a very personal level, is going to affect me. What about you, Claire?
Yeah,
So I was supposed to be going to a wedding on Saturday. Mm-hmm. That's not happening. And I hadn't got anything particularly booked in. Obviously, my main concern is stopping my isolated relatives from going around the twist. And mm-hmm. I do have tickets for the Twin Woods Vintage Festival in the end of August, August Bank Holiday weekend. And at the moment, I'm still holding out some flame of hope that we might be over the worst of the curve by then. But I think it's very much, it's a long way away. So we'll just have mm-hmm. to see how things progress. But I think one of the things...
What is that festival, Claire? Is that some cider drinking thing?
No, it's... There's an old World War II airbase up the road, and it's where the Glenn Miller Band was based as their base while they were going out and playing to the troops in the war. And then that's where he flew from on his last flight and never came back. So it's in about its 13th, 14th year now, but it's got bigger and bigger. It's fantastic. It's literally just up the road from my house. So, so it's a lot of fun. And I've been going with my dad for the last sort of 3 years. This will be our fourth year. And so they have a lot of vintage music and style from the sort of 20s jazz age and bluegrass stuff through to the kind of 60s. And most of the people who go dress in vintage, and it's just fascinating to just watch the crowds. It's great dancing and there's great music. So it's a lot of fun. But I'm still hoping that it will be far enough away that it'll be okay. But we'll see.
How about you, Emma? Any immediate plans which have gone for a Burton? Sorry for our American listeners, you're gonna have to cancel.
I was supposed to go karaoke this weekend. That's not happening. I had theatre practical every night. That obviously is not happening. I'm probably not coming to see you in June, which is heartbreaking. I feel absolutely so sorry for Claire's friends who are getting married. That must just be awful. I was going to get back into dating, but I guess that's not going to happen. mostly it's just, normal stuff, nothing huge yet, but, just the world shrinking, really.
Last word with you, Ben, over in Rhode Island.
So this is actually kind of interesting. If you take the economic stuff with work out and put it to one side, because my family has so many health issues, I don't do much. I'm traveling more than a day is almost impossible because it's hard to get the kid to sleep in a strange place. It's tough for us to go out because we've had trouble finding babysitters and stuff like that. There's an element where this is just the rest of the world coming to live the way we have been living. It's a little bit more extreme, but the reaction of everybody starting to do online social events has actually been great for us. My dad tries to come up every so often for a visit. Instead of doing that, we did, Skype dinner or, online dinner for two nights, the nights that he had been planning to come up. And that was lovely. And it was actually less stressful than having to try and take my daughter out to a restaurant. and now I've got all these friends who I, don't get to see very often who are setting up like game nights and stuff. And it's like, I can actually participate in society. And that's kind of a nice change in a very strange way. I really wish the circumstances had been different, but it's really nice to be able to be included in society again. If we can get the economic side of this all squared away for everybody else, by that same token, I've certainly got a lot of friends who are musicians and stuff who are, completely up certain creeks, right now. And I feel terrible for them. And I do need my work situation to be squared away, but
yeah, I literally just had a message from my cousin who's a barman, and he's been laid off. So
yeah, exactly. That so yeah, that's sort of where I'm at. It's a very strange place. It's not, this isn't how I'd want it to happen, and there's a lot of restrictions, and it's very scary. Worried about my wife's health and everything. On the other hand, I'm getting, you know, from a mental health standpoint, I'm getting more social interaction than I usually do, and that's kind of positive. So,
interesting perspective. And I think just to kind of end up on this, you're looking at the far-reaching consequences of this. One of them, I suppose, is going to be the fact that there's going to be much more flexible working in the future when employers and employees realize that there are a whole load of industries where people can effectively do their work from home. You know, that is going to be one massive upside for this. Specifically looking at the US, is this going to push the ideal of true universal healthcare closer to becoming a reality? Because maybe one of the outcomes here is that Americans will see that all Americans need to be covered, and that the country needed a unified health response to this pandemic. What do you reckon, Ben?
I would hope so. But we're not going to really be able to know how. The best thing we have for, you know, taking the temperature is probably going to be the next couple of primaries, but then those primaries may be disrupted as well by the pandemic. But, you know, I think the argument in this case is pretty obvious. If people aren't, you know, we're looking at situations where people are having to pay like $4,000 just to take the test without even dealing with like what their hospital treatment and quarantine is going to cost. For people who, you know, or flipping burgers or something, or doing some other, even if they have a decent paying job, but it's an irregular job, the current healthcare system is just not going to cover that. And so they have lots of incentives to not participate in sensible quarantine procedures. You know, all the economics are against them doing so. So it's a pretty clear public health argument that, like, if you don't want the guy flipping your burgers to be giving you coronavirus, probably we should be paying for public health care. I don't know if that's what's going to happen. It's been such a talking point since the 90s. I don't know how much people's opinions are going to shift from one crisis like this, but from my point of view, everything is up in the air right now because of this crisis. There's so much narrative that's being shaped on the fly that, you know, we're just going to have to see what happens.
Who knows exactly when this is going to play out and how it's going to play out. But let's move from COVID-19 and us looking at things, understandably, in a sanguine and negative way, to our takeaways of the last 7 days.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
if ever we needed something to pick up our spirits and a way in which we can embrace our fellow man, it's after, I can say, the week, the last 24 hours, the last 2 weeks, the last month that we've all had as being citizens of planet Earth. So I'm going to turn to you, Ben. Big bearded Ben in Rhode Island, for you to go first and tell us about something which is going to make humanity smile.
Do you remember the movie Dragonheart?
No.
It was panned critically. It didn't deserve the hate that it got, but it was not a good movie. And it involved Sean Connery voicing a giant CGI dragon. and then otherwise a very nice, very stupid little fairy tale story.
So are you telling us that we should all go back and rewatch this?
Yes, but there's more.
Okay.
For some reason, this movie that everyone hated when it was released, except for maybe a core group of cult loyalists, they made three sequels. And they're all on Netflix. Mm-hmm. So, if people are looking for something to do this week, or in the next week, I haven't done it yet, but a Dragonheart and sequels marathon seems like a very nice way to pass some time, possibly consume some intoxicating substances, and, you know, if you can get your friends to watch along with you on whatever video service you want to do or follow along on Twitter, that might be a fun way to pass some time.
You know what, Ben, you haven't sold it to me at all, right? I'm sorry, I'm keeping it real, sir, but other people can make up their own minds. How about you, Emma Burnell?
I think we've all just been thinking about like how to better spend leisure time alone. So I'm going to reread all of the Terry Pratchett Discworld novels from start to finish. I love Terry Pratchett, and he makes sense of a confusing world for me a lot of the time. And I think that kind of humour and pathos and heart will be exactly what I'll need. So that's what I'm going to do.
Awesome. And what about you, Claire?
Well, I also discovered an old film on Netflix this weekend. I sat on the sofa with my daughter Saturday afternoon and we watched, well, a lot of stuff actually, but we watched Clueless, which is a sort of mid-90s sort of teeny comedy, which is very, very, very loosely based on the story of Emma by Jane Austen.
Yes.
And
after which I'm named.
Oh, really? Well,
yeah, I was supposed to be special, and then my mum read that book and then named me after the main character. And I'm like, but why? She's awful.
I was just a famously disliked, unlikable person, isn't she? Not that you are, of course. Interesting. I mean, it's sort of mid-90s, and I was slightly too old to have seen it when I was a teenager. I don't know, really, but actually, it stood up pretty well. I thought some of the music was cracking. The fashion was,
yes,
well, a lot of fun. actually, it really, really brought home to me how that kind of, it's that kind of Valley Girl speak that, you know, I hear from my 12-year-old daughter now, really kind of came to prominence, I feel like, in that era. And, you know, and we're still living with it now. So, yeah, but it was actually quite a lot of fun. So worth a relook if you've not seen it in some time or never.
If I can just add to that, I was coming to age sort of around the time that movie came out, and it sort of says something that every band from that era that I loved, I end up finding out that they were on the Clueless soundtrack. It's just one of the best soundtracks. The movie isn't my personal favorite, but the soundtrack is just absolutely stellar.
Great music.
My takeaway is I watched a film called 21 Bridges, and as an aside to this, because I think 21 Bridges is still in the cinema, obviously cinemas, movie theaters are going to take a massive hit, but I'm presuming that, and I've kind of read this, that a lot of films which were planned for theatrical release in 2020 are going to go straight to streaming. The Black Widow movie is kind of one of them, the big Marvel movie, which is coming out in May. But 21 Bridges, it's the story of a heist gone wrong. And it's a very simple movie. It stars Chadwick Boseman as the one cop who's a good cop, who goes after these two wrong-uns who've tried to nab this coke from this restaurant. They know there's some coke in the fridge of this restaurant, and they go there and there is literally 50 times more cocaine than they were ever led to believe. So what do they then do? And then the police turn up, and then all hell ensues. But the police do not turn up to arrest them. And that's the great thing. And it's called 21 Bridges because there's 21 bridges outside, out of Manhattan, and the criminals need to get out of Manhattan with the cocaine loot, so to speak. And what's brilliant about it is you don't have to think too much about it. It's beautifully shot, very well acted. And you completely side with the criminals. And you want them to get away with this. You want them to get to find that bridge to get over, to get out of Manhattan so they can go off with their loot. The secondary criminal is just played so well, and your heart goes out to him. He's very smart. You understand he's in way over his head, but he's a good guy. And as I said, it was just a very simple film. You just watched it. It didn't have to engage your brain. There weren't loads of subplots and meta other meanings, but the writers still managed to flip your sympathies, and you want the bad guys, in inverted commas, the bad guys, to get away from the good guys, the cops, because the cops are not that good. So 21 Bridges is my recommendation for just a great movie you can watch with the family, and everyone can take something away with it. And then very lastly, I was saying this to Ben just before we started recording, I found myself falling down YouTube rabbit holes about World War II. And again, as I was saying to Ben, as somebody who loves history, World War II is a gateway drug into history. It's very easy. You know, the bad guys are so fucking awful, right, that you can't help but be interested and fascinated and just shocked by the inhumanity that man can display to his fellow man. And the scale of World War II is just epic. You know, it's the ultimate Hollywood movie. The bad guys are dressed really well. They have the best uniforms, the coolest helmets and whatever, but they're fucking evil. And then the world finally gets it together to defeat the bad guys. So it's very easy as a teenager to fall in love with World War II documentaries. And also because you can physically see the footage in a way that we can't really with any other major conflict that goes on beforehand. So I've fallen into this YouTube rabbit hole of watching Time Ghost History, where there's a guy called Indy Neidell who sits in front of a camera in a in a 1920s, 30s kind of set, and tells you in about 30 minutes a specific bit of either World War II or intra-war history. So whether it is how Mussolini came to power or the Italian invasion of Abyssinia, or, and this is where I really just like, you know, dare I say, self-jerked myself. It's a case of looking at the constitutional breakdown of Yugoslavia and how the king in 1929 then assumes dictatorial power because the country just did not work. He goes into such fascinating detail and does it so well, so engaging, with him just looking towards the camera. And you feel completely like he's just talking to you. This isn't some dry lecture at all. Utterly brilliant. So Time Ghost History is the channel. And he's done the First World War. He's done World War II. World War I is the Great War. Then there's the interwar period. But it's just brilliant. Time Ghost History. Go listen to those. Watch those, sorry. And then if you really do want to nerd out, and I know us boys do, but the Eastern Front is, again, it's the ultimate World War II front in terms of it's millions and millions of men, strategic massive blunders, soldiers coming back without eyelids because they're frozen off. You have the mass starvation of people. It's just the numbers desensitize you as to what actually went on when you look at the Eastern Front. But there's a British guy called Tick, T-I-K, who I think he's from Manchester, who sits in his study and goes through, reads you the runes, so to speak, on what happened on the Eastern Front and why some of our preconceptions, i.e. the Germans were defeated in part because of the Russian winter, etc., etc. And he does it, again, in a very engaging way. His production values are not as smooth as Time Ghost History, but my God, does he know his stuff. He's read every book on the Eastern Front and of all the commanders, and has a majestic overview and take of it. So whilst we're all sat at home with our loved ones, I think we're going to need some self-isolating from our loved ones as well, aren't we? And to take our laptops and our tablets into our bedrooms and whatever, and just splurge and indulge ourselves on some streaming media. And I can't recommend the film 21 Bridges and Time Ghost History enough. Ben Jacobs, it's been wonderful to have you on, sir.
Great to be here.
Why don't you tell people what podcast you do and where they can find you on social media?
Sure. When by night, when I'm not a planner,
you fight crime.
I fight crime by making a podcast about early modern Europe called "Witness to Westphalia: The Wars of the Reformation." Although we actually haven't gotten to the early modern period yet, we're still doing deep background, and I'm 3 years in. Mm-hmm. So it's "Wittenberg to Westphalia: The Wars of the Reformation." The website is www.podcast.weebly.com. I'm on Twitter at www.podcast. There's a Facebook page. There's a fan group that's very active. So come check me out.
How about you, Claire? What other podcasts do, I wonder?
Oh, well, I co-host a podcast called Map Corner, where we celebrate
maps. Oh, that sounds fascinating.
I know. And we celebrate maps, mapping, cartography, travel. And
Claire, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
How does a mapping podcast work on a podcast format? Because that sounds like a contradiction in terms. Please sell it to me.
Well, you'd be surprised how people can speak so eloquently about a visual medium.
Mm-hmm. But I hear that your co-host is a bit of a dud, and you literally have to carry the show yourself.
If it were not for the co-host, there wouldn't be a show at all.
Ah. So that's mapcorner.space, I believe, is the URL for that. Great. Do we know what the next Map Corner podcast will be about? Other than just maps, of course.
I can't think off the top of my head. We'll have to have a production meeting.
We'll do that after this one then, shall we?
Sure.
Brilliant. Emma, what about you?
Well, sadly, I'm not on Fun With Flags. But I'm sorry, Roy, but I couldn't resist. Sorry, Claire.
Sharky mare.
But I can be found on Twitter at @EmmaBennell_. And I am on various podcasts whenever anyone asks me to be on one. But I also have a monthly podcast called The Zeitgeist Tapes, which is where me and a professor of political history take a piece of popular culture, so a TV show or a movie or a book sometimes, we've even done a play, and talk about how it depicts politics. So the most recent one we've done, very fittingly for this local government-based episode, was on Parks and Recreation.
Oh, fandabulous. Of course, you can contact me. Well, there is. I do have a presence on Twitter, but I can't spell. Grammar goes out the window. See, you might be horrified if you follow me on Twitter. But I, sorry?
You're perfect for Twitter.
Absolutely, then, I suppose. But I do a whole kind of smorgasbord of podcasts. Podcasting is what I do. So, and I actually have a tiny bit of news. My very first podcast was a thing called How Jamaica Conquered the World, which looks at the spread of Jamaican cultural influence. And people say, what? How could Jamaica conquer the world? And the whole point is that the island of Jamaica is only 2.7 million inhabitants and it has a disproportionate effect on modern world popular culture. So without the island of Jamaica, there's no hip hop even. The first exponents of that creative form in the United States were all Jamaican and Caribbean immigrants. And that's just kind of like one way. And that's before you go into the more obvious links to the reggae and Rastafarianism, etc. So I did that back, started that in 2012. And really by 2014, and my other podcasts had kind of somewhat taken, had really taken my attention away from that. But I was approached by a publisher to put that into book form last week. So it's been a, so if you are a fan of that podcast, a book should be coming out in the next 12 months or so. Ooh. Yeah, so really didn't half make my week last week to be approached by a legit publisher. And yes, so, and they've given me a contract, and How Jamaica Conquered the World will be with you in book form. Other than that, I've just finished a podcast, 10 American Presidents, with Corey Brettschneider, who's sometimes of this podcasting parish, about the history of impeachment. And then, of course, I do Matt Corner with R. Claire. There's Dumpty Dum, which I do with R. Lucy, and Intelligent Speech, and a whole load of other things besides. But that's me. If you want to know more about what I do, go to royfield.com. That's been us, somewhat downbeat, I think, for understandable reasons. Just trying to put a very human face on the pandemic, which is sweeping the world. And without wanting to lash out too much about the various powers that be about their response, because if we're all human, we can say this has taken us all by surprise. We are going to have to pull together, whether it's families, individuals, communities, societies, and nations, to combat the most serious health crisis, the most serious crisis, full stop, since the end of World War II. We need to do this together. Take care. Look after yourselves. See you all again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.